So this evening's address, dear brothers and sisters, is the chronology and work of Ezra and Nehemiah. So, the chronology and work of Ezra and Nehemiah. The Jews returned to their land. The temple and the walls are rebuilt. And for the most part, the people are obeying the law. This, actually, in a nutshell, brothers and sisters, is the work of Ezra and later Nehemiah, and as such, from it, we can receive a tremendous lift. For once, the Jews are in the land, and they're obeying God. How extraordinary that is. To begin with, we will look at the chronology as getting Ezra and Nehemiah into their correct historical context helps us to understand the way they fit together in the sequence of the Old Testament, and that in turn may help our overall understanding when we next read or study these books. Now, when looking at the chronology, there are some basic problems which we will come across. For instance, difficulties arise partly because the layout of the books are not strictly in diary order all of the time. The writings sometimes take the form of a collection of personal memoirs, and partly because we are not familiar with their dating system. Of course, because they were before Christ, they did not record their dates as nice, neat series of numbers, 450, 500 BC, etc., because it didn't exist. At the time, they used a cardinal system, which means they dated the year from the length of the time the present king had been on the throne. And we are familiar with the terms, for example, of the seventh year of Artaxerxes, etc., etc. This problem is compounded because lots of kings had the same or similar names, or even were known by more than one name. But the records do not make them easily to identify. For example, there are at least three Dariuses, and several Xerxes, and also several Artaxerxes. So bearing this in mind, our point of departure must be the end of the Book of Chronicles, and this serves as a good lead-in, which we have put on this overhead. Can you see that? Okay. So this is an historical overview of the 200 years spanning the last chapter of Chronicles to the end of the period of Ezra and Nehemiah, which is just off the edge of the chart. I'll move that up later. So 2 Chronicles chapter 36, verse 5, there's no need to turn to it, records the sad ending for the time being of the line of Judah as kings in Jerusalem. The chart in the middle shows Jehoiakim, who reigned 11 years, was the subject of Nebuchadnezzar's first conquest and captivity around 605 BC. And we can see that in the middle of the chart. So the left-hand side are the kings that we may or may not talk about. The middle part is what's going on in Judah at the time, and then some of the events on the right-hand side and the dates, so 610 BC to 410 BC, and for example, the first captivity, the second captivity, the fall of Jerusalem, etc. And some spaces between Zedekiah and Zerubbabel, and then on to Ezra and Nehemiah. There was then the boy king, Jehoiachin, who was just 8 years old when he was taken off to Babylon, to be succeeded by Zedekiah, who reigned until the final destruction of the temple and the city. And so from this, we can see that Nebuchadnezzar was God's instrument for punishment for his unworthy people. And Chronicles says, they became servants to him and his sons until the kingdom of Persia came to power. The chronicle says, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah the prophet, the Lord moved the heart of Cyrus to make a proclamation. So, of course, all these kings and God's people themselves were moving around, all in accordance with God's plan, even if we can't quite work out where which king was in charge at the time. God knows. He moves people around, and God's plan is gradually fulfilled. And the proclamation sets the scene for the later work of Ezra and Nehemiah. So through this, we see the order, brethren and sisters. Nebuchadnezzar on the left-hand side of the overhead, followed by his sons, followed by Cyrus, who made the proclamation concerning the work described by Ezra. So far, so good. And this is where the chronology gets a little more complicated. For Daniel, the prophet, states that Belshazzar was slain and Darius the Mede took the kingdom. Also, on the slide, who is this Nabonus we have mentioned around 550 BC? Well, the answer to these questions was that Nabonidus was emperor, so to speak, and appointed his son, Belshazzar, as the king or the immediate ruler over the province of Babylon. So here we have the idea of emperors ruling a vast state and a province being controlled by a king, rather like in some countries, in France, for example, you have the president and the prime minister, and they have different sequences of office. For the name of Cyrus, two theories exist. One theory is that Cyrus and Darius the Mede were the same person, and another theory is that Cyrus was the dominant leader of the Medan-Persian alliance, with Darius the Mede appearing as a kind of prime minister in Babylon. Now, in all honesty, it doesn't make any difference to our journey to the kingdom, but I guess it's nice to know when we're doing the readings. So I guess here the choice, as is two or three of them, is you take whichever one you feel most comfortable with. But to add to the confusion, we should be careful to avoid confusing Darius the Mede with Darius the Persian, whom we will later speak of and come across in Ezra's chapters 4 to 6. Anyway, we can say without doubt that it was Cyrus who ultimately made the decree which answered the aging Daniel's prayer, which is recorded in chapter 9 of Daniel, and it led to the return of the people to the land. We'll put the overhead back up later, but let's just have a look at Ezra's book now. Turning to the book itself, we have divided the contents into two sections. Broadly speaking, the first six chapters of the book of Ezra are concerned with the initial return to the land under Zerubbabel. And we stress this was actually around 120 to 140 years before Ezra's and Nehemiah's time. And if I just try and overlay this here, you'll see what I mean. So the first six chapters actually concern this time around Zerubbabel, and there's a huge gap then between Zerubbabel and the time of Ezra. And we'll deal with that in a second. So we stress that the time, 120, 140 years or thereabouts, is before Ezra's and Nehemiah's time. But Ezra is actually recounting the history and does himself not appear in his own book until chapter 7 of the book, shown on the overhead as Ezra's return and reforms, just here. Chapter 2 of Ezra records the list of those who went up with Zerubbabel, and we note that the Nehemiah of verse 2 in that chapter, we won't turn to it, is not the same Nehemiah of the book in which his name appears and which we'll speak later. Chapter 3 of Ezra records what we have termed on the overhead as the revival of the temple worship in the second year of their return. In this chapter, the altar is rebuilt, sacrifices are offered on it. We also learn of the beginning of the temple reconstruction with the laying of the foundation stone. And that must be an exciting time, or have been an exciting time for Ezra and the people, and of course for God as well. And then we come on to chapter 4, and this is where we need to have our wits about us, because this is the biggest cause of the chronological confusion in the whole accounts of Ezra and Nehemiah. The beginning of the chapter is fairly straightforward, but when we come to the talk of opposition mentioned in verse 4 of chapter 4, we have to be careful. And at this point, it will be helpful to refer back to the historical overview. Just read Ezra 4, verse 4. Then the people of the land weakened the hands of the people of Judah and troubled them in building, and hired, verse 5 for connection, and hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, until even the reign of Darius, king of Persia. This talk of opposition to the building and the ceasing of the work jogs, as it were, Ezra's memory, and he reminds his readers of later opposition, principally in his own days. Verse 6 speaks of Ahasuerus, or as the NIV renders the name, as Xerxes. And verse 7 of our chapter, speaking of Artaxerxes. But as we can see from the overhead, this is in Ezra's time, and actually he's referring to Zerubbabel's time. So as we can see from the historical overview, this is many years later, and it has nothing to do with Zerubbabel's time and the building of the temple. For by the time of these two kings, that's Artaxerxes, the temple had been completed for a number of years. Well, unfortunately, the compilers of the chapter paragraph division in the authorized version were a little unhelpful. And to avoid the confusion and to get things into the proper context, we need to insert a paragraph sign, or perhaps more easily, a bracket at the beginning of verse 6 of chapter 4, and then skip all of the intervening sections until we get to the end of verse 23, where we insert the closing bracket. This thereby neatly encloses Ezra's thoughts, which concerns Artaxerxes, and which at this moment lay in the future. If you remember, I was saying that the first six chapters of his book actually are referring to time before Ezra was actually born. So having inserted our brackets, we have then solved the problem and can now join the record together by way of chapter 4, verses 1 to 5, with verse 24, and then onwards as normal, as if they were just continuing. So let me just read a couple of verses just for those, just to illustrate that point for connection. So verse 4 and 5 again. Then the people of the land weakened the hands of the people of Judah and troubled them in building, and hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, even until the reign of Darius, king of Persia. Then skipping to verse 24, then ceased the work of the house of God, which is at Jerusalem. So it ceased until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. So let's go back to the Ezra overhead. So having cleared that little confusion up, chapter 5 of Ezra, following a new beginning, inspired by the prophets Haggai and Zechariah, the opposition is renewed with the writing of a letter to Darius. But by God's good hand, the adversaries were silenced by Zerubbabel, who quoted the original decree of Cyrus, and which was later further confirmed by Darius. So again, just flipping between the two, we can see here that Haggai and Zechariah, up at this point, were writing their letters of encouragement concerning the historical part of Zerubbabel, which Ezra refers to in his chapters 1 to 6 of his book. And so finally, the temple was finished in around 516 BC, being some 20 years after the foundation stone was laid and around 70 years after its destruction. Well, with the completion and dedication of the temple, the 70 years of desolation were fulfilled, and almost 60 years are dismissed with the opening words of chapter 7, "After these things." Now, at last we meet the man from whom the book is taken. The first five verses give a list of Ezra's descendants and take us back to Aaron, thereby establishing his strong pedigree. Following this introduction, the letter of authority from Artaxerxes appointing Ezra as ruler over Jerusalem is recorded for our benefit. We won't read it tonight, of course, but when we do read it, we marvel that this heathen ruler would agree to give assent to such a document. It is phrased with such reverence for the God of heaven that we are forced to wonder at the way of our Father and how he influences the events on earth. The letter opens with the words, "To Ezra, the priest, teacher of the law of God of heaven, greetings." And this opening salutation would not have been out of place coming from one of the apostles. Amongst other things, Artaxerxes, a man to be feared, follows this up by allowing any Israelite to return to the land. He allows them to take gifts of silver and of gold. Not only this, but he reminds them of what will please God in the way of offerings. And he allows them to acquire from the royal treasury anything needed for the temple. And all of this, remember, from a man who did not worship our God. Suddenly, in verse 27 of chapter 7, we are aware of Ezra, the man himself, whose voice breaks into the narrative with the delightful phrase, "Praise be to the Lord, the God of our fathers, who has put it in the king's heart to bring honor to the house of the Lord in Jerusalem." Here is a man who trusted in God and who was prepared to demonstrate his faith by his works. Verse 28 of chapter 7, because the hand of the Lord, my God, was on me, I took courage and gathered leading men from Israel to go out with me. The hand of God, mentioned in this verse, becomes almost a refrain, for in chapters 7, 8, and 8, it is mentioned 6 times. Ezra is continually reminding himself, and the Israelites, and ourselves, that although he had to summon courage to do his work, it would have come to naught had it not been for the decisive hand of God. Here, brothers and sisters, is a strong reminder for us, even though we may put our hands to the plough and plant, it is only by the gracious hand of God that increase is provided. Moving on, chapter 8 lists the families of those who went up with him in the 7th year of Artaxerxes and describes the journey to Jerusalem in some detail. Now, we won't dwell on the chapter, but it gives us a wonderful insight into Ezra's character and his practical faith. And from it, we can gain exhortation concerning trusting God's hand. That phrase again, trusting God's hand in whatever circumstances that we may find ourselves. And moving on, the last two chapters of Ezra deal with the way he had to contend with the problem of mixed marriages. We can see from the dates given to us in the record, again, no need to turn to it, in chapter 7, verse 9, in chapter 10, verse 9, that 4 months had passed since Ezra had arrived in Jerusalem to the time that the mixed marriage problem was brought to his attention. The reason for this gap is possibly given to us in chapter 9, verse 2, where we are told that the leaders and the officials have led the way in this unfaithfulness. And this, we feel, is borne out by the reaction of Ezra. When I heard this, I tore my tunic and cloak, pulled my hair from my head and beard, and sat down appalled. Appalled until the evening sacrifice. Wow, what a character. These actions and subsequent confessions and prayer recorded in verses 5 to 15 are not the words of a man who turns a blind eye. Ezra was clearly shocked, and as a man of God, falls on his knees before the Lord. As God's representative, we are left with the impression that, as with Moses, Ezra is taking some of the blame for his people's actions and heaping their sins on his own head. Now, the basic theme of the prayer is as follows. We have always sinned, yet the Lord has been merciful to us. You, Lord, warned us not to mix with the people when we entered the promised land. Yet we disregarded your advice, and what happened to us was our own fault. You graciously provided a remnant of the people, yet we have sinned greatly again. And as a result, verse 14 of chapter 9, would you not be angry enough with us to destroy us, leaving no remnant or survivor? Because of it, not one of us can stand in your presence. Ezra, as we indicated, was totally deflated by the unfaithfulness of the people, and his dramatic show of disgust continues in chapter 10, with more praying, weeping, and throwing himself down before God. To Ezra, a faithful man of God, it must have felt like God's people had finally come to the end of the road and finally had committed one sin too many. but it was not to be. Ezra's extreme show of mourning draws many people to him, and following a public admission of sin, a plan is developed. The people say, "Let us make a covenant before our God to send away all those women and their children. Let it be done according to the law," which I guess is a phrase we don't often associate with God's people. Let it be done according to the law. And so we hope we have shown that Ezra was a faithful servant of God, who tried at all times to do the things which would be correct in the eyes of the Lord, not in his own eyes, even if it meant that some difficult decisions were to be made. God was with him in all that he did. A lesson for us, surely, there indeed, to stay close to God. He will stay close to us and be our guide. He will guide our thoughts and he will guide our actions if they are made with the best of intentions. But, dear brothers and sisters, we have not seen the last of Ezra. He reappears in the story some years later and presents the positive and festive aspects of the law. However, to get to this point, we must go back indeed to the section we skipped over in chapter 4, where we put the brackets around the record. For this serves as an introduction to the book of Nehemiah. But let's just break for a hymn first. Imploring him to intervene in the rebuilding of Jerusalem. Unfortunately, Artaxerxes was persuaded that this rebuilding was not politically expedient, and he sent a letter to get it stopped. On receiving the letter, Rehum, Shimshai, and other opponents of Ezra compelled the Jews by force to stop the rebuilding. And we can assume from Nehemiah 1, verse 3, that they also took the opportunity to again destroy the rules. But before we confirm that assumption, here is the breakdown of the chapters in Nehemiah. So let's now confirm that assumption that we have made. Hanai, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some other men, and I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that survived the exile and also about Jerusalem. They said to me, "Those who survived the exile and are back in the province are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates have been burned with fire." When I heard these things, I sat down and mourned. Here then, brothers and sisters, is another reason for expanding the study of Ezra to include Nehemiah as well. For by limiting our study, we do not get the benefit of the full picture, and indeed, it could be misleading. For example, it has been assumed by some scholars that Nehemiah's distress at the destruction of the walls of Jerusalem was caused by the sacking of the city of Nebuchadnezzar. But as we have seen, this was about 150 years earlier, and therefore, why would Nehemiah suddenly get upset about something he had known about all his life? As we've just heard, he was in fact upset because he had heard from messengers from Judah, that the work of rebuilding being undertaken following Ezra's expedition had come to nothing as a result of a letter from Artaxerxes and the orders contained therein. And so following this terrible news, Nehemiah mourned. He fasted and he prayed for several days. And a wonderful prayer it is too, brethren and sisters. Truly a prayer of a man who wanted to serve his God just as Ezra had done before. And yet, even with his prayer on his lips, Nehemiah was still sore afraid, as the record says. As he came into the presence of the great king Artaxerxes in chapter 2, a man all-powerful, could do anything he wanted to, in a human sense, to any of his subjects. But a greater king was with him and answered the prayer that he'd just been uttering. And so in the 20th year of Artaxerxes, with letters to guarantee his safe passage and secure building materials, we see Nehemiah leading yet another expedition to the Promised Land to restore the flagging spirits of God's people and to once again rebuild the walls. Generally speaking, until the wall was completed, the majority of the chapters record details concerning the rebuilding work itself. But rather than just dismiss these chapters, it is worth noting that it was not plain sailing for Nehemiah, even though he did have the letter from Artaxerxes. Chapter 4 of his book records that Sanballat became angry and ridiculed the Jews. There was also a plot to fight against the builders. But once again, after prayer, and that's itself an exhortation for ourselves. After prayer, Nehemiah posts guards and makes arrangements for the Jews to be armed and to be ready to fight, thereby thwarting the threat. Every builder wore his sword at his side, and Nehemiah was accompanied by a trumpeter at all times to call the people to arms. But Nehemiah was not just relying on his own strong right arm. For verse 20 of chapter 4 says, "Wherever you hear the sound of the trumpet, join us there. Our God will fight for us." Our God will fight for us. After dealing with internal problems in chapter 5 of Nehemiah's book, he is again faced with external opposition from Sanballat and from his allies themselves in chapter 6. This time they threatened to send a letter to Artaxerxes accusing Nehemiah of establishing a kingdom once more in Jerusalem. But Nehemiah was of strong character. He was not to be deflected, and following yet another prayer, "Now therefore, O God, strengthen my hands," we learn that the wall is rapidly completed in a period of 52 days. What Nehemiah managed to accomplish in under 2 months, in arduous conditions, faced with unveiled hostility, was an outstanding achievement, one that must thrill and provide encouragement to all of us who read and study his word. In the natural sense, Nehemiah's motto was, "Let us rise up and build. But this was also his motto in a spiritual sense as well. Any consideration of the rebuilding work undertaken by Ezra and Nehemiah must recognize that they were involved not just in rebuilding walls, but in rebuilding and revitalizing the morale and the spiritual state of the entire nation. Surrounding them with solid stones must have seemed an important thing for the people at the time. But it was much more important that the people were reawakened to God's promise that he would be a wall about them if they obeyed him. Now, we mentioned earlier that we had not seen the last of Ezra. And it is a joy that both Ezra and Nehemiah were able to work together on some aspects of the spiritual revival. To Ezra, Nehemiah had no doubt been an answer to prayer, and now, with the rebuilding work completed only 6 days previously, Nehemiah steps aside and allows Ezra, in his role as priest, to address the people. We are told in the early verses of chapter 8 that the people were assembled as one man in the square before the water gate. And as Ezra steps forward on a specially erected platform and opens the book of the law, the people rise as one, as is the custom in the synagogue. For Ezra, it must surely would be for us, as it would be for us, to stand there before the people must have been a faith-building and a humbling experience at the same time. And can we imagine the scene? The entire nation of Israel standing there as one, rising when Ezra opened the book of the law. Ezra endured much hardship, as we have learned, but the Lord had answered his prayers. Let's just read a few segments of chapter 8 to get the feeling of the occasion. Chapter 8, reading from verse 5. Ezra opened the book. All the people could see him because he was standing above them, and as he opened it, the people all stood up. Ezra praised the Lord, the great God, and all the people lifted their hands and responded, "Amen, amen." Then they bowed down and worshipped the Lord with their faces to the ground. What an incredible scene. From the record, we know that these events took place in the seventh month of the Jewish year. It is interesting to note that this is surely no accident in this, because this was the most important month in the Jewish calendar. For during this month occurred the Day of Atonement, the day of at-one-ment with God. Ezra, as a priest of the Most High God, would without a doubt be aware of this as he proceeded to read the law before the assembled people of God for 6 hours. Just a little shorter than this address is. 6 hours, brethren and sisters. Can you imagine it? Chapters 8, 9, and 10 really provide us with a breath of fresh air. For the normally stiff-necked and rebellious Jews mourn the fact that they have for so long been estranged from their God and eagerly rededicate themselves to him. In chapter 8, verse 9, because the people were so deeply moved with feelings of remorse, we are told that they wept. They wept as they listened to the words of the Lord. On the second day of study, the people learn that during the Feast of Tabernacles that they should live in booths. And so keen were the people to please the Lord that the whole company who had returned from exile, they built booths and lived in them. Chapter 8, verse 17 says, From the days of Joshua, the son of Nun, until now, the Israelites had not celebrated it like this, and their joy was great. And on the 24th day of the seventh month, at the conclusion of the Feast of Tabernacles, a national assembly was held in accordance with the law. Chapter 9, verse 1. We are told that the Jews complied with this and gathered together, fasting, wearing sackcloth, and with earth or dust on their heads, all sign of remorse and self-denial, mourning and humiliation. chapter 9, verse 2. Those of Israelites' descent had separated themselves from all foreigners, and surely this is a sign that the repeated readings of the law were bearing fruit. They stood in their places and confessed their sins and the wickedness of their fathers. And so following this national confession of sin, a prayer is given which recounts Israel's history, showing the forgiveness, the kindness, the mercy, and long-suffering of God towards a rebellious and a wicked nation. We quote, "In view of this," the people say in verse 38 of chapter 9, "we are making a binding agreement, putting it in writing, and our leaders, our Levites, and our priests are affixing their seals to it." And so a covenant is made, and perhaps the national feeling can be summed up in the last few words of chapter 10. "We will not neglect the house of our God." Well, dear brothers and sisters, surely for all its imperfection, here was an earnest in miniature of that future restoration for which we long. As we see in our mind's eye, Ezra and Nehemiah leading the two processions along the top of the wall during the dedication of it in chapter 12. And we rejoice with them in this. We're not told what happened to Ezra and to Nehemiah in the end. We are told that Nehemiah remained in Jerusalem for 12 years until the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, when he returned to the king of Persia. We also know from verse 6 of chapter 13 that he obtained leave to return to Jerusalem in an attempt to sort out the problems of the Jews who had once again transgressed God's laws. However, one thing we can be sure of is that both men would face the future trials, and the work in the sure knowledge that God was with them. Well, we hope that this brief revision of the basic chronology and the work of these two servants of God will assist us as we read their books through the Bible Companion. And in conclusion, there are three points we would like to bring out. The first is that nobody knows the outworkings of our Father. He uses and maneuvers the kings and the rulers of this world to achieve his purpose without either them or us being aware of it. Our lesson is that we must make sure we work for the Lord and not against him by trying to the best of our abilities to understand his purpose with the earth through our continued reading of the scriptures. The second point, in connection with the first, is that the hand of God controls and regulates our lives for our ultimate well-being. Ezra recognized this, and by continual referral to the hand of God, he kept reminding himself of that fact. All too often, it is perhaps easy to forget God when things go well, and then to blame God when things go badly. Let us therefore try to remember our Father in all we do, and in all that happens to us as we walk to the kingdom. For we know that it is through much tribulation that we will receive the prize. And the third point, quite simply, is that Ezra and Nehemiah have shown that prayer is powerful. Let us then use this very privileged tool often to communicate with our Father, remembering that with such sacrifices, God is well pleased. And finally, we pray that through our readings, our understanding of God will increase, and in the mercy of our Lord, we will be able to meet with Ezra and Nehemiah in an even more beautified temple than even these two faithful men of old could ever imagine.